DW Spectrum with Connor Dillon.
Oh, I will give you something to break. Hello and welcome to Spectrum. My name is Connor Dillon. And on this show today, we are going to talk about a couple of acts of destruction. And these are some of the biggest scales imaginable here on planet Earth, but also some of the teeniest, tiniest, smallest scales you can possibly imagine. And when I say small, I mean really, really small. Like the smallest stuff that human beings can even say is actually there, and that really does exist. And the reason we know it exists is because we are so good at smashing stuff. With more on that is DW's Kathleen Schuster.
Imagine you're out for a walk in the middle of an open field when suddenly you see a couple of pink bowling balls. Well, this is an odd sight, so cautiously you walk closer, and that's when you notice that there are a couple of black bowling balls sitting right next to the pink ones. Okay, so as you're bending over to inspect this odd collection of pink and black balls, you hear a sound above you. Whizzing way above your head, you squint and see a couple of ping pong balls zipping around. Well, now, this is really odd. So you watch the ping pong balls for a while, and then you notice something strange. The number of ping pong balls up above corresponds exactly to the number of pink bowling balls on the ground. Well, that can't be a coincidence, can it? And then it hits you. You're standing inside an atom. Of course, it all makes sense. The ping balls are protons, the black balls are neutrons, and the ping pong balls, those are electrons. You plop down to the ground to take it all in. Wow. I mean, just wow. But after a while, well, you kind of get bored. So out of curiosity, you pick up one of the pink balls. That's odd. It doesn't quite feel like a bowling ball, does it? It feels different. It moves differently in your hands. So what could be inside? Well, no one's looking, are they? No. So you raise the pink ball high above your head, and with all of your might, you slam the ball into another pink ball. One of the pink balls cracks in half, and rolling out of that ball is one of the strangest sights you've ever seen. Three objects, each the size of a tennis ball, and dripping off these balls is a kind of gross-looking sticky glue. Ugh. But you ignore the glue and pick up the balls anyway. Oh, the balls actually spin in your hand all on their own. But wait, do they have batteries inside? How does that even work? Whatever. Anyway, then for reasons that you can't even explain to yourself, you just can't help it, you lick each of the three objects. They kind of taste good. Two of them taste like cream cheese, like a light cream cheese even. And the other one, it kind of tastes like sour cream. Heavy, rich sour cream. You're left with sort of a milky taste in your mouth that's somewhere between sweet and sour. It's kind of like, what's it called again? It's like that dairy product that so many Germans and Scandinavians eat. It's called quark. That's it. These objects taste exactly like quark. Well, congratulations. You are now a particle physicist and you've discovered an elementary particle. It is called a quark. Now, let's go smash up some other stuff and see what comes out.
Yep, let's go smash some other stuff now. What you just heard there involved basically a human being throwing a ball at another ball. And that's pretty cool, but that is not nearly enough power to destroy an actual proton in real life. So for years, the best way to slam a proton or any two subatomic particles into one another at enormous speeds was at the Large Hadron Collider, that is the LHC, and it's here in Europe, it's on the border of Switzerland and France. And the LHC, this is the biggest, baddest, most powerful particle accelerator in the world. It is 27 kilometers around in diameter, so this is a ring-shaped thing, and that is 17 miles. So this thing is just huge, and it's run by a European research organization called CERN. It's funded by 23 member states, including Germany. And now they have announced plans for a new collider, and it will be 100 kilometers around. This thing will make the Large Hadron Collider look like a kind of hula hoop for a child. Now, I think this is great, but there are a lot of people who are very skeptical about these kinds of science mega projects, especially expensive ones. And I have warned my next interviewee that I'm going to kind of play a role during our interview, and I'm going to be the concerned German taxpayer. I am not sold on this concept. So on the line with me now is Johannes Gutleber. He is the scientific secretary of the Future Circular Collider Study. So that is what the new particle accelerator is called, the FCC. So Johannes, how, if you're just adding more energy, if it's literally just a bigger collider that you're building, you know, it's 100 kilometers instead of 27 kilometers around, how is that going to solve anything? I mean, it's just more energy and they just hit each other harder.
Yeah, so that is a very good question. So actually, the Future Circular Collider program envisages two steps of particle colliders. The first one is actually an electron and positron particle collider in a 100 kilometer long tunnel. And this one, actually at a lower energy, lower collision energy of the Large Hadron Collider, permits us to study with a very, very high precision the phenomena of the inner workings of the universe. So if you wish, the Large Hadron Collider today is too coarse to look into these small deviations from the standard model.
You mentioned that it's a kind of a two-step process. This reminds me of China's plans for particle colliders. In 2030, they want something that's slightly bigger than the current Large Hadron Collider. And by 2040, they want the Super Proton-Proton Collider to be ready. I didn't misspeak that. That's actually what it's called, the Super Proton-Proton Collider. So they're building a huge 100-kilometer ring, maybe by 2040, that's the plan. Why not use theirs? And then we can all save money and, you know, just kind of share and collaborate together.
The Chinese plans to go for such a two-step process is actually a confirmation that the worldwide physics community has a strong interest and actually a need for such a particle collider-based research program. Now, the collaboration at the scientific level is in fact ongoing. Now, at CERN, we believe that we are in the best position to host such a project because of the more than 60 years of experience that we have in building up particle accelerators, and we have an operating very high-performance particle accelerator complex here, the necessary legal and procurement infrastructures.
But could you, in theory, do the same research in China's, you know, conceptualized 2040 super proton-proton collider? Could you do the same stuff?
Now, one thing is the particle collider. You can consider that as an infrastructure for the research. And China recently, in the last years, has certainly acquired a lot of technical expertise in that direction. Now, the other question is the experiments that you have to build around these particle colliders and the worldwide researchers' communities who have then also to do the physics research. Now, this is today not so clear. At CERN, we have a very long-standing tradition of open access research, and we believe that these communities which exist are eager also to make the next step and go ahead with the planning and designing of the experiments at such new particle accelerator facilities.
The rough cost estimates of this project, and they're always really rough when you're talking about these mega projects, but it's about 25 billion euros. Now, I did the math. If you were to walk through or walk around the 100-kilometer ring, that'd be about a billion euros every hour of walking. It's really a lot of money.
So these 25 billion that you were quoting are comprising the two-step process. Now, the first particle collider would cost about 5 billion, and the tunnel would also cost about 5 billion for it. But even if we had all the money available today, we wouldn't be able to just go dig it and build that machine. Here at CERN, with our worldwide physics and engineering community, we are creating the new technologies. We are enabling the construction and operation of such machines by developing new technologies together with our academic and industrial partners.
So is it fair to kind of compare this to like a, I don't know, a supersonic space airplane that doesn't exist yet, but you'd have to create the wings first or create the materials first just to get it off the ground?
Yes, that is correct. You can, for instance, compare it to the development of particle colliders in the past. The Tevatron at Fermilab pioneered the superconducting magnets. And because of this development, today you have medical imaging devices like magnetic resonance imaging in the hospital. If you break your bone or you have another kind of disease, today you can look into the body just because there exist technologies that have been developed for particle colliders. There are numerous other cases and examples for technologies that have been developed for healthcare and industry that really directly come from the development of particle colliders. The World Wide Web is another example.
Well, if you guys kind of helped make the internet, then I'm a fan of you. I really like the internet. I'm happy it's here. Mm-hmm. Now, up to this point, I've been kind of taking on the role of the German taxpayer. I'm going to swap hats and put on a sort of French-Swiss hat, if that makes sense. And I'm going to bring something up that came up this morning at Deutsche Welle, and I know it came up when the Large Hadron Collider was first being built. Aren't you just going to be creating black holes under these poor people's feet? What if you suck them in and planet Earth disappears?
So the Future Lepton Collider is working at energies much lower than the Large Hadron Collider, but also for the Large Hadron Collider, our physicists have done extensive studies if there are any risks for the population or for humankind associated. There have not been found any evidence or any hints that unknown particles, which would be dangerous for the environment, could be produced at such kind of machines.
Is that a long way of saying that you are creating mini black holes or you're not?
No. Black holes are not created at the Large Hadron Collider and will not be created at the Future Circular Collider, Lepton Collider.
Let's assume that this plan goes through. What is the best case scenario for the Future Circular Collider, the FCC? When will it be built and how long will we be able to use it?
The last machine would end operation in the year about 2090.
My goodness. Well, we're going to have some time to talk about this issue. Johannes?
That's why we need to invest in the youngest generation now and build them up. Yeah.
Okay, well, best of luck to you, that sales pitch to the young generation. And Johannes, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you very much for the interview.
Well, from smashing particles with enormous amounts of energy, and again, that was Johannes Gutleber back there from CERN, to one of the most powerful and destructive forces on our planet. Volcanoes. Now, to preface this next bit of science news, we are first going to briefly return to a show that I did last year, and in that show, I visited a lake here in Germany that is less than 60 kilometers or about 35 miles from where I am sitting right now at Deutsche Welle. That lake is called Lake Lach or Lache Lake, and that lake sits on top of a German volcano. So here we are at Lache Lake. This is the place, this is the epicenter, this is what Volker was talking about, that eruption, that Germany-altering eruption that happened 13,000 years ago and that covered parts of Germany, especially parts around here, in upwards of 60 meters or 200 feet of ash and rock and lava bombs and all sorts of nasty stuff if you were trying to live here at the time. The lake itself is down in a bowl, as you might expect. It looks like it's about a mile or maybe 2 miles across. That's always tough to guess when you're looking at a body of water, but much larger than the bodies of water I was looking at before when I was talking to Volker. And there's another huge difference with this lake, something I am looking at right now and that I have never, ever seen before. And I'm going to let you listen to it first. So try to ignore the sound of the lapping water and just focus on a hissing sound. That sound is the sound of thousands of air bubbles escaping from the kind of rocky ground below the water
and coming up and popping on the surface. Now, as Folker explained before, these are CO2 bubbles escaping from beneath this lake. And as he described it, this is the result of magma cooling, releasing the gases from within the magma. They kind of creep their way up through the rocks and eventually escape here. So we are looking at and listening to CO2 escaping from below this lake, from below my feet here, and out into the air and ultimately into the atmosphere. But a very clear sign, a very clear visual that a lot is still happening here. A lot could still happen here. And as Folker said, we don't know if it's going to happen in the next 10 years, 10,000 years, 100,000 years, million years. But there's a dynamic process still happening, a lot of volcanism still happening underneath this place. And it could be the site of another very fatal and very dramatic eruption here in Germany. That said, for the moment, it just looks like a very beautiful lake on a very beautiful sunshiny day. And I, for one, am going to take a little dip.
Okay, so I enjoyed a really nice swim in that lake, but as it turns out, I really should not have done that, especially in light of news from German geophysicists. On the line with me now is a professor of seismology, and he's also the section leader of the earthquake and volcano physics at the GFZ. That's called the German Research Center for Geosciences in English. And his name is Torsten Dahm. So Torsten, I'm just going to kind of translate on the fly the title of your press release from Potsdam. And it's basically saying that this lake, Lake Lach, which is very close to where I'm sitting right now, there are deep earthquakes showing that magma is rising beneath this lake. That sounds scary. What is happening here?
Yeah, actually, so we concluded in our work that it is possible that magma is rising, but actually we cannot say for sure that a large amount of magma is rising, but it can actually really be the case that magma is rising from a very deep level to a shallower level, but still within the crust.
So I'm going to jump to the big question that I think that most people in the Rhineland area of Western Germany will wonder when they read this kind of headline, which is an eruption imminent under Lake Lach?
No, we don't think this can be concluded. We don't expect actually immediately a rupture or very soon or in near future. And it's very difficult to say how long it will take until an eruption might occur again at the Lache Lake or Sea. But it shows us that there's activity going on and also magmatic activity. And it's the first time that we have direct evidence, meaning direct in a sense to observe seismic signals. So we know it's really occurring now or in this moment when we observe the signals.
This volcano is so destructive. 13,000 years ago, it erupted with such violence that it stopped the Rhine. Its ash stopped the Rhine. I still can't get over that. It makes me wonder, how are we monitoring Lake Lach right now, and what should we improve, maybe?
So, for instance, the observations we have now possibly have only been able to resolve these tiny signals because we improved, in a group of scientists, the network, the seismic network. But it's actually still not optimal, I would say. But there are other important signals that should be measured continuously and in real time, as, for instance, the gas flow, also the chemical analysis of gases in these places where we know that gas from deep mantle source is coming to the surface, and also the little uplifts or deformation or movement of the surface can be measured today with geodetic data. So, for instance, with GPS, with continuous GPS, this is not in place at the moment and would be very important to better judge and recognize if there's really activity also rising up to shallower levels.
Now, this is a lake that has sailboat rentals, rowboat rentals. You have a lot of Germans heading to this lake in the summertime for a swim. Are you saying that the gases bubbling out of Lake Lach aren't being actively monitored? Is that typical not to do that?
There had been occasionally investigations of the gases, So they are monitored, but not in a continuous manner. So we have no real-time monitoring of these gases.
So what is the next step for your research when it comes to Lake Loch?
Yeah, I think so. Because of this new findings, we think that there are several really open questions which are needed to be answered and investigated better. And one key question is really whether there are already magmatic reservoirs of larger volume existing in the shallow crust, or maybe even in the intermediate depth or a deeper crust. So this would be very important to know and to understand in order to better understand the real volcanic hazard. It's not so easy to investigate this, to answer this question, but with some effort and maybe even a mixture of real plant geophysical experiments, this possibly can be answered. So I think this would be very important as a next step to do.
So again, that was Thorsten Dahm from the GFZ in Potsdam, Germany. And before we leave Thorsten, I'm going to let him have the last word on why I really should not have swum in that part of Lake Loch.
Yeah, I mean, with volcanoes, as in everywhere in the world, it can always be that something changes quickly. And also the flux of gas or the amount of gas coming out might change, and it would be important to know this. And maybe to react also for the safety of tourists.
Well, we have got time for a little bit more of German science. And since it's cold here in Germany and in Europe and in the Northern Hemisphere generally, what better time to talk about colds. On the line with me now is Professor Thomas Mertens. Thomas Mertens is a virologist here in Germany and the chairman of an organization that encourages vaccinations throughout the country. Thomas, thank you for being on the show.
Hello.
And Thomas, you have a stuffed nose. You have a cold, don't you?
Really, I have a severe cold at the moment, so that fits very well with an interview about viruses.
How can someone who has spent his whole career and just retired from it investigating viruses, how come you're still getting them? Wouldn't you know how to avoid viruses?
Yes, that's correct for many viruses. But with rhinoviruses, let's say the viruses that induce the common cold, it's a little bit difficult, you know, because they are transmitted quite easily. And, you know, there are more than 100 subtypes of these viruses. So you have a long list of viruses which you can get through your throughout your life. So in other words, with some viruses, you can protect yourself quite easily. And with other viruses, it's a little bit more complicated.
Okay, so we will go back to the rhinovirus, to the common cold virus in just a moment. But first, let's take a big step back. What is a virus, actually?
Many people think that viruses are some kind of very small bacteria, but that's not correct, you know. From the biological principle, bacteria, like humans, they are organized as cellular individuums. So a bacterium is a cellular entity, whereas a virus is only genetic information with some protein around and sometimes some enzymatic functions in it. So it is not able to replicate by its own. And this is a very different, it's very different from bacteria.
Okay, so real quick, bacteria can have babies all by themselves, and a...
Bacteria divide, you know, from one cell, bacterial cell. After division, you get two bacterial cells, which are identical. If you get a virus within a living cell, then you have a complete different replication. It's not dividing. The virus is not dividing. But the virus is replicating in the sense that you get one virus in the cell and then you have in different compartments the production of molecules, and then you have an assembly process like in the modern car industry. And then at the end, you have, let's say, 1,000 viruses in one cell which has been infected. It's a completely different mode of replication.
Okay, so let me see if I can sort of visualize this. A bacteria is kind of making photocopies of itself, but a virus is hijacking a cell and turning it into a virus factory.
Right, exactly. That is what is written in most textbooks of viruses.
So what's so difficult about stopping viruses? Why do we have so many antibiotics and things that can kill bacteria? But when it comes to viruses, I keep hearing, you know, Connor, you're going to have a cold. You're going to get colds every year for the rest of your life. Why can't we stop these viruses?
We can't stop these viruses today. You know, there are a lot of very effective antiviral substances or drugs, even drugs. If you think of the HIV-infected people, if you think of the hepatitis C-infected people, if you think of the herpes simplex virus-infected people, we have very efficient drugs against viruses. But the problem was that if you want to hit a virus, you have to try to hit the virus without killing the cell. You know, if you remember what we said a minute ago, then the connection between the virus and the cell is very tight and very strict. So the trick was to find a way to kill the virus or to inhibit replication of the virus without damaging too much the cells.
If you killed the cells that the viruses were in, would that kill me? Is that too much? Would it just annihilate my body?
It depends on the cell, you know. If you think of your brain cells, probably not so good. And yeah, it depends. It depends very much on the cell. But anyway, we can make the statement that the problem of the therapy is that we need the virus-specific drugs. That means drugs that are hitting the virus or the virus replication without doing too much damage to the cell.
Okay, let's go back to the virus that is sitting inside your nose right now and that is making you cough and not feel very good. You said that there were 100 subsets, roughly 100 subsets of the rhinovirus, the common cold virus. Sounds like a lot. It is a lot. But we could come up with vaccines against those 100 rhinoviruses, couldn't we? And then we'd stop the common cold and we could all go to work and feel better?
Yeah, that's theoretically it might be possible. But you can imagine that it is impossible. Let's say we have about 115 serotypes of rhinoviruses. And we cannot do 115 vaccinations in one person just to prevent a common cold, you know, because that would be very, nobody will do that.
I would like to say that I would volunteer.
Okay.
If it meant no colds for the rest of my life.
Yeah, okay. But you have still to keep in mind that you will have to make immunity against 115 different serotypes of rhinoviruses, only rhinovirus. It is an interesting task, and people are working on it, to produce a vaccine that is able to prevent, let's say, a big number of different viruses in one vaccine.
You said that's being worked on.
Yes.
What's the time frame? When can I stop getting the common cold?
The time frame for vaccine is long. I think it is possible, but it will take quite a long time.
Okay, so Thomas, I'm going to let you get back to fighting your own cold virus, your own rhinovirus. Thank you for joining us on Spectrum today, despite the way that you feel.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, that is it for me this week from Connor Dillon here in Germany. I hope you enjoyed the show. Look, if you have an opinion on the new particle accelerator that's being planned for Europe, we would love to hear from you about it. We are spectrum@dw.com. Or if you also live in the shadow of a volcano like we do here in Western Germany, go ahead and write us in. Or even if you just have a cold, give us a shout out. We will write you back. I would like to thank our studio technician today, Leon Novak, and to thank all of you for listening in to this week's broadcast. On behalf of all of my colleagues here at Deutsche Welle,
please do have a wonderful and cold-free week ahead.